Hello, foreign entanglements viewers. My name is Dr. Rob Farley. I work at the Patterson School of Diplomacy and International Commerce at the University of Kentucky. With me today is Dr. Adam Lowther, and we're going to talk about all things Air Force. How are you doing today, Adam?
Great, great. Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Cool. Could you introduce yourself to the viewers?
So I'm Adam Lowther. I'm a research professor at the Air Force Research Institute, which serves as the think tank for the Chief of Staff of the Air Force. And we're based at Maxwell Air Force Base, which is home to Air University, the Air Force's School of Graduate Education. So we have the Air War College, the Air Command and Staff College, and a variety of other programs.
So first, thanks for joining me. I think that a lot of foreign entanglements viewers are probably familiar with, you know, I wrote a book and I argue against the independence of the Air Force. If people are interested, Adam and I have had a back and forth about this, mostly in the pages, or also the web pages of the National Interest. And we'll have links below that so you can take a look at, I think there are two of mine and two of yours, and really actually long essays responding to each other. So I guess to start off with, and I don't know whether we should start with the brief for the prosecution or the defense, but I mean, for you, what's at stake in this question of whether or not there should be an independent Air Force?
Well, I guess, you know, as I think about the nature of what an independent Air Force is, I guess, you know, I've had some discussions here lately about what is it that the Air Force does that is different from the other services, and not just what does it do, but how does it do things that make it irreplaceable? Mm-hmm. And so it's more than just, you know, assets and airframes.
Right.
And to me, the critical thing is the command and control of air power. And, you know, the notion of how airmen think about air power and how to utilize air power. And it's, you know, it's distinctly different from how. So, you know, I started my career in the Navy. And so having spent the first 8 years in the Navy, I have some understanding of how the Navy thinks about air assets. And then, you know, I did a deployment to Iraq with some Marines. And so I have a sense of how they think about air power and then how the Army thinks about air assets. And so for the Air Force, the notion of how you have essentially centralized control and decentralized execution vice using, in the case of the Army, air power, at the control of battalion commanders for the purpose of supporting, you know, a battalion of ground troops. And then for, you know, in the sense of the Navy, it's primarily for the purpose of defending the fleet and then, you know, raiding missions. You know, when the Navy attacks the shore, that's effectively a raiding mission. Mm-hmm. So the notion of theater air superiority, the notion of how do you more effectively employ air assets over large ranges and spaces, the notion of how airmen see distance, range, and speed. Mm-hmm. They're very different from how the other services see it. And so to me, it's really that notion of how it's employed, how air assets and air power is employed, that makes the Air Force distinctly different. And if you were to, you know, just as I think you suggest, to take the air assets of the airframes of the Air Force and, you know, disperse them to the other services, it's that you would lose that ability to efficiently allocate air power, you know, in a combat theater.
Right. And you're familiar, you're very familiar, I think, with where I'm coming from with respect to this. I mean, I don't know if you've read the book or you're going to, but you know the argument. So I am not impressed by the performance of the independent Air Force as a service, either sort of as a political unit or as a warfighting unit. And I think this gets to some of the points you just made, right, where we sort of take a look and we compare, you know, how the service, which is designed to think designed to foment a sense of air-mindedness. And air-mindedness is a term that Colin Gray uses a lot, and but a lot of people use it. And you know, I mean, I look at the performance of the Army Air Force in World War II, and I think it compares very favorably with the performance of the Air Force in Korea. I think it compares very favorably with the performance of the Independent Air Force in Vietnam. You know, certainly the Air Force has done better in easier conflicts since then, in conflicts where the United States had overwhelming advantage, regardless of how we had structured our military services. But you know, I realize I'm getting historical here. But you know, we should be able to think about this historically and think about whether, you know, the historical record suggests that the Independent Air Force actually leads to a more efficient employment of air power. And so I look at Korea, where General LeMay refuses to allow his B-36s to be used against Korea because he knows the engines are going to burn out on the way home, and where B-29 formations are cut to pieces by MiG-15s, which are being flown by the North Koreans and the Chinese. And in, you know, in Vietnam, where we're incapable of putting up an interceptor that can fight the MiG-21s and the MiG-17s that the North Vietnamese are putting up, and where Navy flyers consistently outperform Air Force flyers in dogfighting, just simply because of the training, because the training is much better in the Navy, and the formation flying is much better in the Navy. And so from an evidentiary basis, it's hard for me to accept the argument that there is considerable value added, at least in terms of developing a more formidable, more lethal way of using air power through having an independent air force.
Yeah, I guess, you know, let's take the Army Air Forces. I mean, this is really the first opportunity in which, you know, under Hap Arnold and under the other Tui Spots and LeMay and other leadership, mm-hmm. that the Air Forces became, were essentially effectively independent mm-hmm. of ground forces. I mean, granted, they provided close air support, but the bombing missions, for example, were wholly independent of, you know, the land commanders. Mm-hmm. And then so when the Air Force becomes independent in the years immediately following World War II, I mean, think about the notion of the Air Force celebrated its, let's see, what was it, the 70th anniversary here recently. So if you think about the Army or the Navy,
I think 75, it was 75 2 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, so the Army has been around for, you know, armies have been around for thousands of years. The, you know, the U.S. Army is mm-hmm. 200 plus years old, and, well, 300 years old. Whereas the Air Force is a relatively new thing that has not only gained independence in the last, you know, 75 years, but has only been able to accomplish a variety of missions as the technology has developed. So the technology isn't 75 years old. So I guess part of it is just to say that the Air Force has gotten better over time as it has developed the techniques, training, procedures, the you know, the capabilities. So when you say, well, the air power did better early on, and I guess my point would just be to say that you know, air power has developed over those preceding, you know, those decades that came after World War II and after Korea and after Vietnam, and that the reason that you have such dominant air power today, I mean, of course, everybody says, yeah, wars are easy for the Air Force. I mean, nobody can touch us. And my point is, yeah, and the reason is because the independent Air Force has looked at the utilization of air power in such a way as that it was able to develop a set of capabilities that nobody could touch, and that would have never been the case. So this is a counterfactual, mm-hmm. but that, you know, absent the Air Force being there to advocate for those capabilities and to develop a mindset that said, okay, now here's how we should employ air power, that you wouldn't have that. So for example, when it comes to bombers, historically, the biggest opponent of the bomber force has always been the Navy, because they were fearful that bombers would replace, you know, battleships and carriers because they had such long range. And so if you didn't have an Air Force, you wouldn't have a bomber force, because they would have always opposed it, as they always historically have. The Army has taken a similar...
Well, I mean, if I could at least pause for a second there. You know, we did not have an independent Air Force prior to World War II, right? Air power was part of the United States Army. It was the Army Air Service, the Army Air Corps, and then the Army Air Force. And actually, I mean, I think that the Army allowed the Army Air Corps to over-focus on bomber aviation at the expense of pursuit aviation and the expense of attack aviation. But, I mean, it's a bit of a strain to me to suggest that we wouldn't have a bomber force, right? I mean, the Soviet Air Force was, the Soviet Air Forces were always subservient to the Red Army, and they nevertheless had a significant bomber force. I mean, we can argue about how independent the Chinese Air Force is right now, but it certainly wasn't independent 10 or 15 years ago, and they had a bigger bomber force than they do now. So, I mean, I guess that's one way of responding, that, look, we do have examples of armies that have aviation corps that develop long-range aviation. And this goes back to sort of one of your comments, and this was from the latest, or from your last piece, and again, we'll link to this. If we hadn't built all those bombers, that I wanted to stand up and cheer when I read that for you, because that's great, right? I mean, if we had built the USS United States in 1949 instead of B-36s, that would have saved us so much money. If we had not built the B-58, that would have been great. If we hadn't poured money into the B-70, that would have been great. You know, these would have been good choices with respect to the history of sort of U.S. defense procurement. Although I appreciate you're not going to agree with that, but I guess that's where I'm coming from.
Well, I guess it's like any, you know, like any technological system. You know, I mean, you can think of automobiles that, you know, Americans have bought, where they can look back historically and say, well, geez, I wish I wouldn't have bought that Chevette.
Right.
I wish I wouldn't have bought that Fiat, or I wish it would. But
there's a Nissan Sentra in my case that I really just wish I had not bought. But yeah.
Yeah, and so, you know, that's the notion of the development of air power, is that you have a lot of, you know, and this is, to me, I think the problem with modern air power is that we don't have those aircrafts. And what I mean by that is we're so focused now on ensuring that we have that one silver bullet, which for us now is the, you know, it's our one aircraft, you know, one fighter multi-purpose aircraft that we're building in the United States. And so we never go through those stages of having these other aircraft that are not the silver bullet. And to me, that's more the problem than having aircraft that are not, you know, magic weapons.
Right.
So I'm willing to accept the LeMay's desire for a nuclear powered bomber. And I'm willing to accept, you know, all sorts of.
It was a great idea. It would be flying around for weeks, right? The crew would never get agitated in doing that. But it's such an interesting idea. LeMay is such a fascinating figure.
Yeah. And so, you know, I think you have to take the Air Force, you know, I guess part of my critique of some of your work, it would be just that it looks at the very early days of the Air Force, and in many respects, the Air Force, because of its, you know, youth and its technological nature, that it's the more recent history that I think is the most relevant, because, you know, what happened, whereas the Navy, for example, I was at a Navy conference not too long ago, and somebody had written in kind of like under the banner of the conference title, they had written 200 years without change, because the Navy just doesn't change.
Yeah, that's not ideal.
And so, whereas the Air Force is in constant change and flux because of its nature and because of just what it is. And so whenever I read somebody, you know, read something that talks about, you know, the Air Force from, say, Vietnam or before, I have to be honest, I really don't care, because it's almost irrelevant to the modern Air Force and its application of air power today and in the future.
Right, so let me try a different tack. And I know you and I argued a little bit about this with respect to, and it does get back to the penny packets argument that's really commonly made, but with respect to sort of why the Air Force was founded in the first place. And, you know, there are different arguments historians make, one of which is that sort of people came to an understanding of the need for a centralized air commander in campaigns, and they came to this understanding in 41, 42, and 43. And then there's the argument, which I tend to be more of a partisan of, which was that strategic air power, the combined bomber offensive, the bomber offensive against Japan, were sort of really central to the Air Force's case for strategic air power. But sort of just setting that aside for a second, I guess, and did you read Ben Lambeth's Air Land Reversal, where he made the argument that most of the destruction is now caused by air forces rather than ground forces, even in campaigns like Cobra 2 and Desert Storm and so forth?
Yeah, I mean, I've read a good bit of a bit stuff, but I can't recall if I've read that specifically.
Right. So I guess an argument that I would make is that your Air Force after 1972, which is at this period post-Vietnam, when you have the development of Red Flag, which is synonymous with the rise of the fighter generals, which is just a classic text on the early history and sort of the middle history of the Air Force, that in fact there's that you're right that after 1972 the Air Force gets much better at what it does, right? That from my point of view, it sort of sets aside the World War II strategic generals, sets not completely aside, but no longer prioritizes strategic air power and focuses more on tactical air power. But in doing that, and I'm not the first person to make this argument, right? People in the Air Force, including, I think, even John Warden, have sort of made this argument that in doing that, it sort of undercuts its own reason for being, right? I mean, and the argument would be that you look at Desert Storm in 1991, and this looks like a campaign that could have been effectively waged by an Army Air Corps that had focused on interdiction, closer support, that had focused on fighter bombers, that did not focus on strategic aviation, did not focus on sort of effects-based operations, that this looks like the sort of force that the Army could really come up with on its own, right? That it didn't need the Air Force to come up with what was essentially a tactical Air Force that had its strategic effect by destroying the Iraqi army in the desert, or at least by facilitating the destruction of the Iraqi army in the desert. And that you have this again in 2001, and again in 2003, and again even in 2011, where the primary strategic effect of the Air Force is not long-range strike for effect, but rather the close destruction, and even the mid-range destruction, of field and enemy forces. And if you buy that, Billy Mitchell, Hap Arnold, the whole lot of them would not find that a compelling logic for an independent Air Force. They would see that as a compelling logic for an Air Force that remained part of the Army.
I see what you're saying, but I think it's a look at the platforms. It's a platform-centric approach that. And what I guess I would say is that, so if these assets were in, the Army Air Corps, mm-hmm. or the Army Air Forces, whatever we would decide to call it, they never would have engaged in, they never would have had the air doctrine that would have sent them to perform those specific missions. Because if you look at Army air doctrine, mm-hmm. today and historically, what air power did, even if it is a tactical fighters, mm-hmm. the Army would not have the doctrine and would not have the mission planning and would not have the approach to the enemy that would have had it go and wage the, you know, the campaign that ultimately, the air campaign that ultimately allowed ground forces to, you know, wage a 6-day war. Mm-hmm. The Army wouldn't have thought about air in that way. And this goes back to my take on, you know, what is command and control and what is that, that notion of how do you employ air power? Mm-hmm. And because, you know, it's not just the airframes, because, you know, the Air Force has tactical airframes that don't fly 7,000 miles. But it's how do you employ them? I think that's the really the most important thing. And so when you look at Desert Storm, so if you go back to Dave Deptula and Warden, who designed the air campaign, that was not something that the Army was an advocate of. The Army didn't say, oh, yeah, yeah, this makes sense. We should definitely do this. The Army didn't buy it. They wanted to go heavy. And they didn't see the utility of air power.
Well, part of the Air Force didn't buy it either. I mean, it wasn't the final plan that was executed really doesn't resemble Warden's initial plan hardly at all, right? I mean, Warden was pretty clear, and there were people in the Air Force who were pretty excited by this idea of, you know, launching a strike primarily oriented at the interior two rings, right? At Saddam Hussein's leadership and at command and control. And, you know, Warden argued that if we do this, we can have it over in 2 weeks and we shouldn't attack the Iraqi army at all because we'll need them to go back and occupy Iraq after the end. And, you know, Bob Horner shut him down and other people within the Air Force shut him down. So you're right that it didn't get quite to the army. But, you know, Warden's strategic air campaign sort of never came through, at least as Warden wanted to envision it.
That's in part true. I mean, if you look at the initial campaign, it was targeted, you know, at central regime targets. And then, you know, for example, at the end, I mean, when we have, you know, the highway of death, mm-hmm. I mean, that was just, in many respects, gratuitous violence. And so I think the war...
Let me actually pause you on that. It was gratuitous violence, but, and I want to, for any viewers, there's no compelling logic I've ever seen to say that it was illegal, right? That it was sort of outside legal war. It was Iraqi forces in retreat. You can attack forces in retreat by sort of any, as long as they're not surrendering, as long as the war isn't ending, you can attack enemy forces in retreat. I've had this argument with other people in the past, not with you, but I just wanted to throw that in.
Yeah, I mean, so the war was, you know, well over by that point, and the ability of the regime to command forces mm-hmm. had already been destroyed. So, you know, I think the fundamental nature of what Warden and what Deptula really sought to do, actually it worked. And then if you look at, you know, Iraq War II, I mean, Iraq War II, people talk about 2001 and they talk about, you know, mm-hmm. The pincer, and they talk about how U.S. ground forces came in. And it's kind of like, well, geez, guys, you seem to be forgetting that when the ground troops went home, air power stayed mm-hmm. with Northern Watch and Southern Watch, and air power never left. And so by the time ground troops came back, you know, a decade later, the Air Force had effectively disabled much of the Iraqi military's ability to, you know, put aircraft in the air, to operate its radars, to, you know, they had essentially, you know, season the battlefield to the point that it was relatively easy for ground troops to, you know, to invade the country. And you have to right. give credit to air power for that. And had we been the Army Air Corps, that would have never happened either.
I mean, there are two points I would push back a little bit on. You know, one is, I think the Iraqis in 1991 actually did come up with far more robust communications techniques and technologies than we were sort of capable of destroying, which is why their heavy units maneuvered. They retreated and they maneuvered in front of our heavy units. And so, I mean, Saddam Hussein was able to continue to communicate with his forces even deep into the battle. And I guess, you know, I find it difficult to believe that any Army Air Corps, at least that I'm envisioning, is not going to be able to maintain, you know, fairly low intensity patrols over a fairly small country with an air defense network that's been nearly obliterated and that's under, you know, crushing military and civilian economic sanctions. And so, you know, I guess that's, again, we're sort of to this point of how difficult of a thing are you suggesting that the Air Force needs to accomplish. We should also say the Navy also participated in both of those, and the British also participated with their own independent Air Force, I'll grant, also participated in both of those campaigns. So, and I guess another thing would be some people would argue that it didn't solve the strategic problem with Saddam Hussein, right? That we still, in the end, people felt the need to invade in 2003 with ground forces, although there's no question that the Air Force performed extremely effectively against the Iraqi army in 2003. So,
well, I mean, we had solved the strategic problem in 1991. Mm-hmm. The strategic problem was solved, but there was a political problem that hadn't been solved that
right.
was addressed 10 years later. But, you know, that's kind of a whole other, you know, ball of wax. But go for it.
Well, what would you say... what would you say is the most important thing that the Air Force does that I just don't get? Like, and I know you've sort of suggested, you know, at other times that I don't have quite the perspective, and you may be right about that. But on a, like a day-to-day basis of how to make the Defense Department function, like what does the Air Force do that's you know, basically irreplaceable?
Oh, well, I mean, it's command and control of air power, so... you know, the Air Force is you know, the JFAC in all of the COCOMs. The JFAC is always an airman.
Mm-hmm.
And the Navy tried to build its own C2 network and capability. So both the technology and the practices of how to command and control joint air power.
Mm-hmm.
And it ultimately gave up because it just couldn't figure out how to build a C2 network for air power. And ultimately it was really kind of a good thing for the Air Force because the Navy walked away from it. And this was here in the last, you know, less than a decade.
Mm-hmm.
The Navy walked away and said, you know, yeah, you guys do this and you do it really well and we can't replace it.
Right.
And so, you know, I think that's
the most common answer people give me, like people who really know their stuff give me. So, I mean, that's.
And to me, that's really, I mean, my personal take is, and this is something that I think it's really hard to appreciate. Now, I'm not sure I even really fundamentally appreciate the nature and the role of command and control of air power. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that absent really spending a lot of time, you know, for you and me, neither of us were Air Force or Navy pilots.
Right.
And so there's a lack of perspective that, you know, we both have where we're sitting here as, you know, as scholars to try to think about these big strategic questions where, you know, it's hard to really fundamentally understand it absent, you know, any experience having done it. And so one of the things I would say is spending time in a KOC,
mm-hmm.
where you actually see how air power.
A lot of people aren't going to know the acronym.
The Combined Air Operations Center.
Mm-hmm.
So the place, so Al Udeid, for example, is where the KOC and for CENTCOM and for, you know, the wars in mm-hmm. Afghanistan and Iraq and, you know, there are KOCs elsewhere around, you know, around the world where the Air Force would command air power for whatever region. And so I think it's, you know, and it's, you know, it's a lot of working parts. So it's not just, you know, the F-22s or
right.
F-35s or whatever. It's okay. Well, now what is the logistics network that we're going to need to put F-16s in the Philippines and the aerial refueling capabilities and the heavy lift and the, you know, what kind of, you know, you got to have AWACS up and you got to have JSTARS and you got to have, your space-based networks that are providing, ISR and that full platform of capabilities, like mm-hmm. the space capabilities. So from a historical perspective, much of the space assets that we have are ones that the Army absolutely did not want mm-hmm. And that they fought against, and that, the Air Force, by virtue of its ability to be an independent service, and this is kind of, it gives you parity in the, the money fight. So whenever people talk about the golden mean, where, the Army gets 27.5% and the Navy gets 27.5 and the Air Force gets 27.5 and then DOD agencies get that other 12 right. or 13%.
Right.
Absent the Air Force being there, many of those things would have never been developed, because fundamentally the Army's about, you find, fix, and finish an adversary on the ground. And it's that mindset that you can't just throw some guys in there. And, this is Billy Mitchell and other airmen in the Army mm-hmm. that there's a weight of numbers and a weight of, strength within the service, that if you're not the biggest, guy in the service, you just don't win. And so, and I see it even in, you see it in the other services. You see it, for example, in the Army, there are, the combat arms control the Army, whereas the non-combat arms groups, they don't control the Army. And within the Air Force, rated guys control the Air Force. Flyers control the Air Force. And so there's a lot of other guys, the logisticians and the maintenance guys, and that are, equally capable, equally good, but, they're not the guy in charge, and they're not the purpose of the service. And so when you're not the purpose of the service, then you're ultimately, going to play second fiddle.
Right. I mean, I guess, one of my questions is, if sort of the biggest part of what the Air Force does in terms of facilitation, right, in space, in terms of command and control, in terms of logistics, and making air power happen, and making the other two services capable of what they want to do on a day-to-day basis. If those guys are already second fiddle in the Air Force, and most people seem to think they are, what's the difference between having them second fiddle in the Air Force and having them second fiddle in the Army, right? That, it strikes me that Army people are smart. Army people and Navy people are going to understand the need for space-based capabilities. They're going to understand the need for human capital to make their GPS work. They're going to understand that they need satellites, right? I mean, the Army was developing ICBMs before the Air Force was. The Air Force took them over, but the Army was developing space capabilities just like the Navy was. And in other countries, in China, right, I mean, you have a fight over space between the Air Force and the 2nd Artillery. A lot of this seems to me to be, the outcome of modernization in what is certainly the largest military in the world, but what you would expect any set of military institutions to do, and that's not dependent on the particular configuration we're looking at. Right, the configuration, the constellation of services that we have right now, especially one that has the Air Force in it and has the Air Force sort of prime of place in it.
Yeah, I mean, just from my own experience, kind of being involved in watching and participating in some of these mm-hmm. fights, and I guess I would just say that, it wouldn't inherently get designed. And it wouldn't inherently, these capabilities we've talked about mm-hmm. wouldn't necessarily get built, or they might not be as robust. They might not be as, so you would still have space, mm-hmm. but it sure wouldn't look like what it does today. And you would have airframes, but you sure wouldn't have the capabilities you do today. So it's not to say that they would completely disappear, mm-hmm. but they sure wouldn't have the capabilities they do. And, just from being there to watch it and to, write about it and to advocate for certain groups as opposed to others, you know, I can see that being a major player is really, really helpful. Right. And if you don't have a dog in that fight, because, you know, so I deal with the French Air Force. Mm-hmm. And the French Air Force has in many respects moved in the direction you would advocate. So they have become increasingly subservient to the Army as the French have cut their defense budgets. Mm-hmm. And if you look at their capabilities, I mean, even for a country, I mean, it's really kind of a preeminent country in Europe, and it's a big country. I mean, they've got, you know, 70 million, 75 million people. They've got one of the 10 largest GDPs in the world. So they're a big country.
One of the top 10 defense budgets in the world. I mean, it's an impressive military establishment, but one that's declining in size.
But their Air Force is really taking it on the chin, and they just don't have the capabilities, nor do they have the ability to advocate for the capabilities, because in that inter-service fight, mm-hmm. They're really not an effective player. And so I guess I would just say that when you're positioned to be something other than an equal, you know, you can expect what being something other than an equal will bring. And that something else is, you know, a lot less capability, a lot less power, a lot less ability to influence outcomes, a lot less of a lot of things.
Right. I guess one more question then we'll see if we can talk a little bit about Ukraine. You wrote in one of your pieces, and we talked a little bit about cyber and space here. Mm-hmm. You at least mused, and I think Colin Gray has also mused about the potential for an independent cyber force, you know, maybe one day an independent space force. Mm-hmm. What is the sort of, even using the argument you just used, what is the logic for the difference in the logic between having an independent air force and having an independent submarine force? Right. Submarine force operates, trains largely independently from the service Navy. It has a culture that's much different than the service Navy. It's expected to do much different things than the service Navy. I guess if you were trying to explain to me, you know, this is why we have an Air Force, and this is, I mean, is it, I guess, that the Air Force does sort of play this larger cerebral, has this larger cerebral vision of how air power affects everything, and submarines, no matter how much distinct they may be, really do have a much smaller part of defense?
Well, I guess for me, I mean, you could make the same argument, well, why shouldn't naval aviation be separate, because it's mm-hmm. distinctly different from, you know, the submarine Navy or the mm-hmm. surface Navy. So Airedales, you know, I was a surface guy. Airedales, mm-hmm. surface guys, and Submariners all think differently.
Right.
They all think that they're better than the other two. I mean, and clearly the surface is the best. I guess it's just that for Submariners and for surface guys and for Airedales, you know, Navy aviation, you know, they all think that they're different and better than the other branches of the Navy, but really they do have a very strong commonality, and that is they operate, you know, above, on, or below the water. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when it comes to, you know, Submariners, it's really not the submarine force that operates independently as much as it is the nuclear submarine force that mm-hmm. is, in many respects, quite autonomous, because the attack subs, you know, so whenever I was working with the Teddy Roosevelt battle group, and we would deploy, we would have submarines that would deploy with us, and they were attack subs. So, you know, they're fairly well integrated, the surface, the air, and the submarine forces. It's really just the nuclear fleet that's...
The boomer fleet.
Yeah, that's autonomous. But, you know, that it's that common domain. So whenever I talk about, you know, that we're going to reach a point where we need an independent space force and an independent cyber force, for me, there are physical domains. And when you can master and deliver kinetic effects through the physical domain, that's the point at which, you know, you need to look at an independent service, because you as the group that operates in that domain will see and understand that domain in very different ways than those who operate in other domains. I mean, sailors see water very differently than airmen do,
right,
and very differently than soldiers do. It's a very different perspective. And so cyber guys, so we do a lot of work on cyber and how to build a cyber force and things of that nature. And so as I have these discussions with real hardcore techie cyber guys, and we talk about simple things like what is cyberspace and what is the nature of it. I mean, just some of their discussion of it, I'm like thinking, well, geez, what are these guys talking about? What are they really?
Right.
And it's just that different. And you know, space as a domain is really right now, it's just it's a transit point for communications. Mm-hmm. And it provides a place for an observation platform, but it really doesn't deliver kinetic effects. So therefore it's not mature enough, or the capabilities are not mature enough to warrant it being an independent service. And so for me, I actually think cyber will be there before space is.
Well, that's interesting.
And in part because of the treaties.
Right. And you can also imagine a cyber force that would have distinct training and recruiting, or recruiting and training requirements that would be distinct from the other services, right? That
absolutely.
Right. Last quick point, you know, if you were to say, what does air power more generally, or sort of the institutional independent air force, and, you know, it doesn't have to solve the problem, but what does an air force do? What does it offer a president, a policymaker, in the context for crisis like we're facing right now in Ukraine and Crimea, right? Is there, you know, which is not to say we want to go and shoot down the Russian Air Force, right? But when the president's looking for answers, sort of what does having an air power oriented service, how does that matter for the answers that are given to he or she?
Well, I think, you know, the number one thing that comes to mind is clearly the strategic nuclear deterrent, both the ICBM force and the the bomber force, as visible means of giving a guy like, you know, Vladimir Putin pause, mm-hmm, to contemplate where are America's red lines and when have I gone too far, and to hopefully give him a reason to think twice about further annexation of the Ukraine or, you know, Belarus or these other places he may have his Armenia, Georgia. And then secondly, I mean, take the F-22, for example. I mean, it has no peers. So if Russian air power were to get antsy, mm-hmm, and to see, you know, for example, they invade the airspace of other countries, then you would have the capability to shoot it down as a very clear signal of American resolve. So you can use air power to signal resolve. And you can do some other interesting things that effectively tell a guy like Putin what America is capable and willing to do. And if you think about it, I mean, think about China, mm-hmm, and Russia. They have dramatically reduced the sizes of their ground forces. They are working distinctly on their naval and air forces and bringing them up to speed. Mm-hmm. And so they clearly understand that the battle is in the air, and they understand where that is where America's greatest advantage is. And so I guess, you know, right now we have that advantage. And so it would be the thing that we would want to use to both deter Russia and then to begin to push Russia back, depending upon how they were, you know, how aggressive they got.
Right. Right. If there were some sort of similar Russia incursion into a NATO country, like one of the Baltic states or something along those lines, right, we would imagine air power being the first responder. Right. I mean, it seems without question. Well, Adam, thank you very much for joining us here today. This has been a fantastic conversation. And hopefully we can have another one sometime soon. And I have to say, what's that?
I was just going to say thanks for having me.
Yeah, no, and I have to say, you know, again, you're a Sun Devil fan. I am a Duck. And so that's why, you know, the little bit of hostility towards Arizona State. But, you know, go Ducks. They're playing tomorrow. I don't know when Arizona State plays, but.
Tomorrow at 8:30.
Oh, tomorrow, 8:30, tomorrow night?
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, you know, for Pac-10 solidarity in the tournament, I guess I'll say go Sun Devils, at least for the first round. So.
All right. Well, thanks very much.
All right. Thanks for joining me.